Welcome in, podcast listeners. I want to challenge you once again. Give us ratings. Give me 5 stars. Write funny reviews. Outkick the Coverage, Wins and Losses podcast, as well as Outkick the Show. I want to get them all over 1,000 reviews. 5-star, make me laugh. I'll read them, and you guys will be able to get an Outkick prize package if I read your review. Go do them. In the meantime, Thursday edition of the show, we're going to entertain you. We got Dr. David Chow, Pro Football Doc, at Pro Football Doc on Twitter, for all the latest analysis of NFL football injuries. AB, Andrew Luck, Derrick Henry, what's going on? He will tell us all with those guys. Plus, we will also talk with Frank Isola from, pardon the interruption, he's been hosting it lately, but also Around the Horn in the Athletic and Sirius XM. Encourage you also to go subscribe for the Wins and Losses podcast. Jeff Fisher is the guest this week. It is phenomenal. You will love it. It's Outkick the Coverage, the Wins and Losses podcast exclusive. But for now, the Thursday show begins now.
Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis, live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the Coverage at foxsportsradio.com. Or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
Now let's get this party started.
You're listening to Fox Sports Radio.
Yesterday, we talked a decent amount about the decision of the NFL to partner with Jay-Z. Yesterday, I got the Wall Street Journal. Jay-Z had sat down. He had talked with the NFL. They had been secretly meeting with him since January. The idea is that Jay-Z is basically going to head up their social justice outreach program that the NFL owners and the NFL players have put in place, and an idea, a goal to make the world a better place, right? That's a very desirable goal. I don't think there's anybody out there who's like, yeah, I hate the idea of the NFL making the world a better place. What is interesting here is that Jay-Z, as part of analyzing his decision to join this organization, the NFL, he said something that I think is really intriguing. And I know he's gotten some blowback as soon as this story went up yesterday. He started to get blowback because we live in a very sort of ridiculous time, I would say. And one of the things we live in that is that's a little bit broken is the idea that you shouldn't interact with people who have different political opinions than you, and different sporting opinions, or whatever it is that kind of spiraled out of the Colin Kaepernick protest. And this quote from Jay-Z, I want to give it more attention than I think it's maybe received from anybody else. Jay-Z was asked about getting involved with the NFL. This is in the Wall Street Journal. Even though he may not agree with the politics of some of his new business partners, NFL team owners. Here's what Jay-Z said, and I'm reading directly from the Wall Street Journal. I'm black. That's my world. He also said, if he didn't do business with wealthy business interests who he may disagree with politically, he said, then I couldn't have any TV shows. I couldn't put my platform on TV because I'm sure someone who owns the broadcast network has supported someone who I don't believe should be in office. I can't control, no one can control the world that we live in currently and people's choice to vote self-interest. And so as a result, this is pretty fascinating to me because Jay-Z is going to be criticized for interacting with the NFL. What Jay-Z represents, even if you're not a fan of Jay-Z's music, and I am a fan of Jay-Z's music, is the ultimate capitalistic triumph of America, okay? And the NFL also represents the ultimate sporting capitalism triumph of America. So to me, it makes sense that a mogul like Jay-Z, who has built his career from nothing through his connection to his audience through music, would be attracted to a league like the NFL, where all of the players and the managers and the owners and the GMs and everybody else have built their audience in the world of sports to a bigger platform than has ever existed before. And what both of them have in common is they have fundamentally flourished in a capitalistic democracy. And the way a capitalistic democracy works is it requires that you interact with people who you might not agree with all the time. Yesterday, we had Dan Wetzel on the show, and Dan Wetzel made a good point. He said, hey, if you were going out to dinner And before you went out to dinner, you said, hey, I'm Christian, but I refuse to go out to dinner with somebody who might be Muslim or Jewish or Hindu. You would be, by most people, I think, ridiculed. Because people would say, well, just because you're going out to dinner with somebody, and even though you disagree with them on religion, doesn't mean that you guys have to agree on every single thing. You can still break bread together and have conversations. And indeed, it's likely that even if you disagree on religion, which is pretty important to a lot of people around this world, you can still find common ground other places. And by the way, the same would be true if somebody was Muslim and they said they wouldn't go eat with a Christian or a Jew or anything else, right? The religion doesn't matter here. So don't people hopping on Twitter, like pointing out the particular religions. My point is that common face-to-face interaction is an integral part of all human relationships. And I feel like we're in this strange era where if you have a different political opinion than someone else, you feel like you shouldn't even interact with them. And in fact, on social media, this whole idea of the cancel culture is that you should try and cancel people who you disagree with. You should take away their ability to have to make a living. You should take away their ability to provide for their family. If somebody has a difference of opinion than you and they share it and you get upset with it, you go to war with them. This happens all the time with mobs on the internet. What I find fascinating about Jay-Z and the owners is Jay-Z is expressly saying here, we don't agree on everything, but we can still unite potentially to find some common good. And what I also find intriguing about this is an idea that I would float for this initiative. There's a lot of talk right now about trying to change things, right? I want to change this institution, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. I want to tear down this institution. I want to alter the paradigm. I want to be a destructive force, right? There are very few things that are really trusted in American society today. And that's one reason why I think sports is so important, because it unites us all and it connects us all. And whether you love or hate Donald Trump, he is a change agent, trying to change things oftentimes that he thinks are broken. And the people who are running to oppose Donald Trump are also change agents who all want to destroy things, right? Like they want to tear down existing structures. What I try to focus on instead of huge seismic goals is something that is very tangible and that is reachable. And to me, that oftentimes has to do with an individual decision-making idea. So Jay-Z and Roger Goodell meet face-to-face, and they end up deciding, you know what, we can be a partners here. We can make things better. And a lot of people out there are going to say, well, the last thing I want is for anybody to be involved in the political process while sports is involved. And I understand that. And in fact, Jay-Z even seems to understand that it's ultimately bad for business, because Jay-Z came out and said that he hopes that Kaepernick will have a platform where he can express himself and maybe it doesn't have to take place on the field. So Jay-Z, even though he is black and many of the NFL owners are white, they speak a common language based on a common color, and that color is green. Ultimately, what is good for business leads to more money. And what's always fascinated me about this NFL dispute, as it has played out over the past several years, is the players and the owners are not warring factions here. They're not two different tribes trying to fight with each other. They're actually all people who are on a boat trying to keep the boat from sinking and hoping that one day they can move to a bigger boat, right? And what I mean by that is, from a pure business perspective, the owners keep 53% of all NFL revenue right now. The players keep 47%. The idea that the players didn't really seem to understand was, in order to maximize revenue, you have to avoid antagonizing your primary client base. The owners, I don't believe, are opposed to the political opinions of the players. They were opposed to whatever cost them money. NFL ratings dropped 19% over 2 years. The owners and the players seem to have recognized that was a bad thing, and they seem to be trying to rectify it. But the thing that very few people understand, because they don't think like Jay-Z, because they don't think like NFL owners, most people think like employees, and most players think like employees, is that ultimately the way to solve a lot of issues is to make everybody more money. And they're not fighting over a slice of pie. They're trying to make the pie bigger. And so what I am thinking of here is maybe a radical idea, but I want to float it out for everybody to hear this morning. What I would actually like to see players, owners, GMs, presidents of teams, coaches, leagues get involved in, if they want to get involved in making the world a better place, is don't try and get involved in things that are particularly partisan in nature. For instance, let me give you a couple of examples. Right now, many different NFL teams tell you when you are leaving the stadium to make sure that you buckle your seatbelt. That is not a political statement. Buckling your seatbelt saves lives, right? Regardless of what your color is, regardless of your religion, regardless of your sexual orientation, if you are listening to me right now in your car, I hope you have your seatbelt buckled, because statistically, you are much safer with a buckled seatbelt. Almost every NFL team, in fact, I think every NFL team does it, stop selling beer sometime during the third quarter. And they also encourage all of their fans to not drink and drive. That is not a partisan statement either. If you drink and drive, statistically, you are more likely to hurt yourself, right? I don't think there's anybody out there who would dispute this. When you drink and drive, if you are drunk, you are more likely to be engaged in an accident and to cause problems, injuries for yourself or others. Those are two things that NFL teams do, which are in no way partisan in nature, and they help to make the world a better place. I think the NFL has a really important role right now in American society, because I think, and I think a lot of you are going to agree with me again, and I don't think this is particularly partisan, I think one reason why we have the violence that we have in American society today is because men, and before that, boys, are not raised in a very healthy environment lots of times. And if you have been a young man at any point in your life, as a huge percentage of people who are listening to me right now have been, you know that one of the dumbest ages that has ever existed for any group of people in mankind's history is young men who were like 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 years old. If you are alive right now and you are over the age of 22, you will look back at some of the things you did when you were 16 to early 20s and say, my God, I was an ignoramus. I was a total and complete idiot. And hopefully you have gained some wisdom along the way, and hopefully you grow up and you'll be a good dad, you'll be a good grandfather, uncle, mentor to younger boys. A lot of people don't have that. And sports for many people is that pathway to adulthood. It's why sports matter in our society. In a fatherless society, so many kids out there look to their coaches as their father figure when you don't have a father at home. You talk to college football coaches, the percentage of broken home kids that they raise is massive, and the number of young boys out there that just don't have a father figure in their life that is reliable or giving them good advice is huge. And if you're not a great athlete, you may not have a great coach in that perspective either, which is why so many athletes become role models for young men and for boys in this country. Okay? I've got something that I wish I could get a huge percentage of athletes, teams, owners, leagues behind that is completely nonpartisan. This is data analytics. I talked about buckling your seatbelt and also not drinking and driving. Those are two things, regardless of what your politics are, you're like, you know what? I think my team saying, wear a seatbelt when you drive home, don't drink and drive, I'm pretty comfortable with that. I don't think that offends anybody's notions of political impartiality. Here are three things that I think are important. And as this platform on this show has grown and we've started to develop a pretty substantial audience, not massive yet, it's going to be massive one day, it's pretty substantial now. Three things that I'm going to drive home over and over and over again, because the number of young boys who are out there listening to me now in the morning, going into school, school season about to start again, you're out and about all over the country, is pretty substantial. And the number of dads with young kids out there, pretty substantial. Moms too. But I think boys in particular are oftentimes getting bad messages in our society today. They're sort of constrained and they don't feel like they're getting the unvarnished truth a lot of times. I think that's why that's so much kind of underground anger that exists for young men. three things that I wish athletes, teams, owners, and leagues could get behind that are nonpartisan and are guaranteed to make a big difference in our society. I'm going to tell you those three things right now. Number one, graduate from high school. Everybody wants to be rich in this country, at least if you buy into the capitalistic doctrine, you do. But one of the big challenges I think that exists in general, as I'm preaching a little bit this morning, is before you can be rich, you have to not be poor, right? And that doesn't sound very complicated, but if you haven't had money before, you're nodding along. You're like, I'd like to be rich, but first I'd like to not be poor. I can't guarantee anybody out there is going to be rich one day. But here are three things that if you do this, statistically, all of the data in America reflects your poverty rate will be basically zero. Graduate from high school. These are individual decisions that every single one of my listeners can manage. If you are listening to me this morning, you can graduate from high school. And your kids can graduate from high school. And your future kids can graduate from high school. That is something you can accomplish. Not saying you have to get a PhD in astrophysics. I'm not saying you have to go and get a medical degree. I'm saying you need to be able to graduate from high school. Two, don't have a kid before you are 25 years old. If you wait until you are 25 to have your first child and you graduate from high school, your chances of being poor are minuscule. All right? Really, really, really low. I'd love to hear athletes going into schools everywhere and tell kids, graduate from high school, don't have a kid until you're at least 25 years old. And here's the third step. And if you do all three of these, you have a poverty rate in America today, regardless of what you're born into, regardless if you're born poor, regardless if you're born rich. If you do this third thing as well, you will not be poor. Can't guarantee you're going to be rich. I can guarantee you're not going to be poor. Don't have a kid till you get married. Graduate high school. Don't have a kid before 25. Don't have a kid until you get married. And obviously you need to get a job in there somewhere as well, but that's kind of, you understand that. You can't just do nothing. But if you do those three things, and if you want to add a job, I'll be the four things that every single person on the planet can manage. You will not be poor in this country. To me, that's almost the equivalent of telling you to buckle your seatbelt. That's almost the equivalent of telling you not to drink or drive. Instead of trying to enact major systemic change, if you individually enact that change in your life, you can make a big difference in your own life. And in so doing, if you reduce the rates of poverty in this country, many of our societal ills begin to diminish. Those three things, or those four things, if you want to call it. This is me preaching to you. I'd love to see the NFL, Jay-Z, the leagues actually get involved in that as opposed to deciding to get involved in partisan political issues. I'm Clay Travis. This is Outkick the Coverage. I appreciate all of you hanging out with us. A lot of preaching there in the first segment of the Thursday edition of the show.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
Let me go ahead and bring in Dr. David Chow at Pro Football Doc on Twitter. We have got so many questions for you as the NFL preseason continues to play out. And I want to start with this Andrew Luck drama. There are a lot of people out there listening to us right now who are Indianapolis Colts fans, and they're like, oh no, this is like a bad horror film all over again. We had the injury situation that played out a couple of years ago where the Colts kept updating us, and then boom, he never ends up playing. Give us a sense. A lot of fantasy football people out there, a lot of people gambling on sports futures. Andrew Luck, how serious is this?
Well, you know, I wish I had all the answers. By listening to GM Chris Ballard, he outright says the Colts don't have all the answers. And obviously, it started with now a calf injury, a calf strain that started in March. By May, when it should be better, wasn't better. There was an injection to try and test it, and it didn't relieve all the pain. They decided to wait, and come training camp, it flared up again, was shut down. And talk even in the last few days of Ostrigonum that came from their owner, Jim Irsay, that's now been put out of the sphere of possibilities. And Achilles has been ruled out. But what is it now? It's a calf strain that has now become an ankle issue. Quoting Chris Ballard, high ankle-ish. Not exactly traumatic high ankle plastic sprain, but the pain is anterior in the, quote, high ankle area. But in the next sentence, it causes pain posteriorly. So what do we make of all this? Clay, I wish I could be more exact. I mean, I'm on the outside. I haven't examined Andrew Luck. Eventually, the story may come clear here. But here's what we know from the outside. That is clearly lingered. It is clearly gone on for 5 months. It indeed may have morphed. Who knows? Is it myositis ossificans, some other different process, a stress fracture injury? Who knows? But at this point, it's clearly lingered for 5 months. Their plan is to alter but continue rehab. The season for week one is 3.5 weeks away. Let's use some logic here. After 5 months, is 3.5 weeks of alter rehab going to get him to 100%? The answer is clearly no. Now, can he play and be effective at 85%? Maybe. Will he play at 85%? By some of his shoulder comments of, look, I've learned to be honest with myself and everybody else, and I'm not doing that to myself again. Admittedly, it's his lead leg, not his push-off leg, maybe less important. It's not his shoulder. But with the lessons learned before, if he's not 100%, will Andrew Luck even want to push it? So there's a lot of unknowns, but what we do know is he will not be 100% week one.
Beyond a shadow of a doubt so far, what is it fair to say this is the biggest injury storyline in the offseason, and there's probably not a close second in terms of its impact on the season?
Well, I think we're all prisoners of the moment. This week, today, Thursday morning, clearly Andrew Luck is the biggest storyline. Last week, Thursday morning, I would have said it was Antonio Brown and his feet. And throughout the summer, I might have said it was Todd Gurley and his arthritic knee. So it is ever-changing landscape in terms of the injury forefront.
What do you think? Let's go. So that's the Andrew Luck update for everybody out there with the Colts. And we'll continue to talk with you. And by the way, you're going to be joining us weekly, which is going to be fantastic, at ProFootballDoc on Twitter. You can also follow Dr. David Chow there. He updates you throughout the week and throughout the days with all of the latest information on NFL injuries, whether it's for fantasy sports or gambling purposes, or you're just a fan of one particular team or one particular player and you want the latest there. Let's go to Antonio Brown. What, if anything, did you learn based on what we saw on Hard Knocks? What do you think is actually going on with his feet?
Well, kind of what we talked about before. I mean, he had some sort of trench foot / excess moisture that started to seep into his feet. And as a result of that, when he went into the cryotherapy chamber, it's not true frostbite where your toes turn black, but the wet, macerated soles of his feet sort of froze, and then he got this freezer burn type thing. Not true frostbite, and we talked about it. It's like licking, if your tongue is moist and you lick the flagpole, we've all seen A Christmas Story, right? And that's kind of what happened to him. And then so the outer layer skin had to peel off, and that's what we saw. It's done that for the most part now. I don't know exactly what date that the picture was from Hard Knocks, but clearly it's gotten a lot better, and I think he's close to returning at this point in time.
So at this point in time, you wouldn't be worried at all about his health status as it pertains to playing week one based on his feet injury?
I really haven't been that worried throughout, but no, I'm not worried. I think he will be there week one. Is he going to suit up in preseason game number two? No way. Could he suit up a little bit in week three? I don't know, but he's going to be there week one. Now, how much will the absence, whether from helmet reasons or foot reasons, from the Raiders training camp in terms of getting acclimated to Derek Carr and their new offense, how will that affect him? I don't know, but I think his feet will be fine come the first game of the season.
Used to work with, at the time, the San Diego Chargers. Another big story associated with Antonio Brown has been his preference for a particular helmet. The helmet changes have helped to decline the number of head-related issues. Did you have any sort of empathy for Antonio Brown over his helmet issue? Or as a doctor, is it crazy to you that somebody would want to use an older helmet given the technological advances that have taken place over the past several years?
Yeah, on my Twitter timeline, I wrote an article talking about the silliness about Antonio Brown and his helmet and the truth. So in some ways, you know, there's lots of craziness. In some ways, I think he has a point. The craziness we've all heard, but the craziest thing I've never heard of in my life is taking your own helmet and trying to bootleg paint it like the Raiders and pass it by. That's absolute silliness. Not to mention the fact that he had notice in over a year, and why are we doing this in training camp in terms of the grievance? But in terms of where he's right, even though there are, quote, better tested helmets, helmets were never invented to prevent concussion. And the best helmet cannot prevent concussions. They may be safer in some ways, and I applaud those changes, but it does not take concussion risk to zero. No helmet can. It's like there's no car designed out there that can prevent you from being injured in a car accident. It still can't happen. Of course, there are safer cars. If you take the famous example of this Viscus helmet, which is the highest rated one that started in 2017, Brian Cushing wore it, and the very first game, week one, he got a concussion. It wasn't because of the helmet. It was in spite of the helmet. But here's the other thing. If this is this big of a safety concern for the NFL, then why did they, and there was this much of a difference between one helmet and another, and clearly there are superior helmets to a magnitude, then why did they allow the grandfathering? Are they saying they looked the other way for a year? No, clearly it was okay, and they were just having to draw the line somewhere. And now you see the compromise. Okay, you can wear the helmet, but you just have to find one that was manufactured in the last 10 years. And that's not a horrible compromise. So there is some truth to his stance, but the way he went about it seemed kind of silly.
We're talking to Dr. David Chow at Pro Football Doc on Twitter. You mentioned Todd Gurley. We also have Derrick Henry concerns. Which of those two backs, if either, would you be nervous about potentially from a fantasy football standpoint or from a ready-to-go week one standpoint at a full, healthy go?
Well, you know, the Titans are famous and respect to Coach Vrabel for the policy, probably learned from from the Patriots, don't say anything about injuries in the preseason. And a calf strain that's fairly acute on a running back alarms me a lot more than a, quote, calf injury. Obviously, it's morphed for Andrew Luck, than one on a quarterback on their lead leg. So there is some concern there. I would probably, as of today, have more concern about Derrick Henry week one than Todd Gurley. But maybe across 16 seasons, that might become a toss-up or might go the other way in terms of arthritis and wear and tear down the road. I still think Gurley will be effective, but I just don't think he's going to be a bell cow 20-plus touch running back anymore.
What else is out there that people should be aware of from an NFL injury perspective, from a fantasy draft or a gambling on futures perspective that I haven't asked you about?
Well, you know, you got a 4-hour show today.
Three-hour show every day. Yeah.
I knew it was a 3-hour show. I just said 4 hours for effect. But here's what I would say. Look, Jerick Lee, if you got the preseason injury report that's available on Twitter timeline for free to all Outkick listeners, et cetera, it covers your team, every team, and essentially every player. You would have seen 2 weeks ago I was worried about Jerick McKinnon before the latest setback. You would have seen last week when I updated, I said Demaryius Thomas is, I believe, going to go on PUP to start the season for the Patriots. There's all sorts of nuggets in there for fantasy, for DFS, for season-long wagering, or just getting your wits about you. And you know, things change so much. I tried to put one out at the beginning of the season because it was a lot of work. I was just going to let it sit. Because there's so many changes, I'm updating it. I updated it after the week one preseason games. I'll update it again after the week two and then the week three, so people can kind of keep up with what's going on. If you sign up once for free, you'll get the updates automatically. And so you don't have to listen to me for 4 hours.
Drew Brees is 40. Tom Brady is 42. Do you factor in age at all when you try and contemplate injury analysis or risk factors in your profession? You worked with Philip Rivers. He's getting up there in age too. Or do you not even really consider age when you look at trying to figure out whether a guy is healthy or not? How much, if at all, do you factor in age?
Well, I think age is one of the many factors and part of shameless self-promotion here, Clay. This wasn't a setup, but just this week, Phillip Rivers was my podcast guest, and he went over all the decision factors into his playing with a torn ACL for that AFC Championship game almost 10 years ago.
Yes.
And you can listen to that. But in any case, yes, age is a factor. The type of player is a factor. The position obviously is a factor. The point in his career, the contractual status, the type of, you know, a strong arm quarterback might be able to overcome an elbow issue. A weak arm quarterback may not. Look, on Andrew Luck's case, what helps him there, it's at least his lead leg, not his push-off leg, right? So we factor all those things into particular circumstances when you look at injury, but it's too simplistic to say this guy's 42 and so therefore he can't do it. It some of it depends on, you know, the injuries that he's had leading into it and the type of offense that he's running. So it's a fairly complex answer. Of course, father time gets us all, but I've always said the most important attribute for a successful quarterback is his brain, not his arm strength. If you're consistently having to throw into tight windows, that's where you kind of get in trouble anyways. You can do it on occasion. It's hard to do that regularly. And these quarterbacks that are playing well into the 40s, you know, obviously you mentioned Breeze and Brady, and you look at what Manning did, you know, late in his career, you look at Phillip Rivers, they're doing it with their brains, not just forcing it into a tight window.
Outstanding stuff as always. We'll talk to him every week. It's Dr. David Chow at Pro Football Doc on Twitter. Read what he writes. Follow him on there. Appreciate it, my man.
Thank you.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Appreciate all you out there listening, starting your morning with us. And I thought it was really intriguing. As you watched the Hard Knocks, I thought the most cool aspect of Season 2, and we talked about this a little bit yesterday, but I wanted to hit on it again because I thought it was in kind of a interesting window into what you have to do in order to be successful. There was the segment with John Gruden when Sean McVay was just starting off at in the NFL, and he was the lowest man on the totem pole with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, working alongside of John Gruden. And there was this great Sean McVay shot where he's standing next to Gruden and Gruden's kind of expanding on, you know, what the future can represent. Do you want to be a coach and do you want to have a future in this league and all these other kind of interesting discussion points. And I just thought it was so cool the way that you saw Sean McVay literally starting at the bottom, right? Jason Martin, I know you're with me. You've kind of lived this if you do what we do for a living, where you come in at the very bottom of the bottom rungs in the world of sports, I think in media or in athletics, in any kind of level. You've got to be the absolute peon of all peons. And it was wild to see how quickly Sean McVay has become a modern day Gruden. To see that, I mean, that was, I think, 2008, 11 years before Sean McVay is the ultimate on the low man on the totem pole. And then through the NFL meritocracy and through dint of what I'm sure is incredible hard work, he has pulled himself all the way up to being the modern day Gruden, the guy who can get a man a job in Cincinnati or Green Bay or Arizona, almost entirely predicated on their connection to Sean McVay. That's how hot he is right now.
Yeah, look, you're not going to get more responsibility until you prove you can handle less.
That's so well said.
Regardless of what it is that you are tasked to do in your life right now, do it to the best of your ability. Exceed the expectations, even if it's the lowest thing that you could possibly be doing. And that's how you actually earn respect and grow in any business or any enterprise. I mean, like, not to talk about myself, but when you were doing a weekend show and you were taping it back in the day here in Nashville, I just kind of walked up to you and sort of cold called you and said, hey, I thought maybe you might want somebody to write about TV and movies for you. I barely even knew you at the time, but I did that because I happened to be in the building that day. And it worked. And then it was, okay, I don't know if anybody's going to read my stuff, but I'm certainly going to put out the absolute best every single time that I do it. But I started as a board operator. Everybody here in this business generally does. And I looked at it and I thought it was even more fascinating to see now in 2019 Gruden talking to McVay, those two coaching staffs, and Gruden saying, boy, you know, I wish we were you guys.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of work to do here. It's like it's completely flipped. Like Gruden's like the old guy, the Pete Bell from Blue Chips, and there's some new head coach that he wishes he was. Like they have completely reversed, and it's because of the effort, and it's because of Sean McVay just finding a way, being intelligent. Yeah, you've got to be good at what you do, but a lot of success is just built around effort and continuing to exceed expectations.
It's about the grind. I mean, it was the phrase is 90% of success is just showing up, and there is some truth to that, being willing and able to put in a lot of effort. And I feel like, and this is really what we spend a lot of time with on the Wins and Losses podcast, there's a lot of celebrating success once success has already arrived, but very little focus on what is required to reach that level of success. We're a very success-obsessed society without being obsessed with what is required to get to that level of success. And so the wins and losses along the way are always, I think, one of the most intriguing parts of anybody's journey because, again, we focus at the end. People like winners, right? They like to see somebody rewarded, but they don't necessarily think about all the battles, the foibles, the trials, the tribulations that have to take place before you get there. And it was a tiny little snippet that took place inside of Hard Knocks. But for everybody out there starting their morning off with us, a lot of people driving into jobs they don't particularly like, a lot of people out there trying to strive to be better, to rise up the next rung of whatever it is you do for a living. And I think in many ways you have to embrace the grind. And I think the NFL is a perfect approximation of that. And the hope is that you can eventually, if you grind enough, end up in a position like Sean McVay has, because it's been a lot of fun to watch what he's been able to do here lately.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
And I think if we were doing a draft right now and I opened up the phone lines and I said, okay, you have to draft an NFL team and you can only read and talk about this particular NFL team for the entire season, I think probably the first two picks would be the Dallas Cowboys and the New England Patriots. Because there are a lot of storylines, the Cowboys, what's going to happen with Zeke, what's going to happen with Dak, what's going to happen with Amari Cooper, Jerry Jones is entertaining. The Dallas Cowboys are America's team, so they have a big fan base. With Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, the Patriots are always going to be top-of-the-line attention. Fox has got the Super Bowl this year. We're going to be down doing Lock It In, which, by the way, comes back on Monday, August 19th. We're going to be doing it from Miami, which is where the Super Bowl is going to be going on this year. And as part of that Super Bowl, there will be certainly a lot of hope among the Fox Sports executives and employees that the matchup will be the best possible matchup it could be. And I guarantee if you gave the president of Fox Sports, Aaron Shanks, the opportunity to draft an AFC and an NFC team to play for the Super Bowl, he would pick the Patriots in the AFC and the Cowboys in the NFC because it would produce the biggest ratings maybe that have ever existed for a Super Bowl, certainly if the game is competitive. But if you couldn't pick those two teams, do you know who'd be the third pick? The Cleveland freaking Browns. The Cleveland Browns would be the number three draft pick on most interesting team to follow this year. And there are probably some of y'all out there right now who say, you know what? I might take him at one or two. And you know who's doing that? CBS. Jim Nantz and Tony Romo are the number one announced team for CBS Sports. Do you know what game they are going to cover week one of the NFL season? The Cleveland Browns. Do you know who the Cleveland Browns are playing? The Tennessee Titans. The Browns are such a big draw right now that even the old boring Tennessee Titans that nobody cares about are still sexy enough because they're being paired with the Cleveland Browns. I want to bring in my guy Jason Martin. He's hanging out with me this morning. Former producer. You heard him last week guest hosting. He has his own local radio show. Do you agree with my draft order there? If you had to go one, two, three, you go probably Patriots for me, number one. I think they're more interesting than the Cowboys. Some people probably a little bit tired of the Patriots, but I think overall the number of interest. Cowboys 2, Browns 3. I'm stunned. I saw this news, and I was like, man, they're putting Jim Nance and Tony Romo. In case you wondered how much of a hype train the Cleveland Browns were a part of right now, that eliminates all the doubt completely. That is pretty outstanding.
Yeah, see, I led off with this yesterday on my show in Nashville because I'm in that weird spot where I have a national show on the weekends. I fill in for you, so I do both national and local. So I have to kind of sometimes take my cone and go inward and sometimes go outward. And I look at the Titans as a franchise that's not particularly interesting to cover on a day-to-day basis. So I think I probably cover it less than others. But I heard yesterday across the media, oh, they're doing Browns-Titans. I bet some of that has to do with the Browns. Yes, some of it. Like 120%.
That's local people saying that. But yeah, like it's all the Browns, right? I mean, that to me is the most interesting thing about this decision is it's not even the Browns against a good team. Like if the Browns were opening right against the Steelers, let's say, you'd be like, oh, that's a no-brainer, yes, right? Like I want to see what's going to happen with the Steelers or if the Browns were opening with the Cowboys or if they were opening with the Patriots or some team that also has incredible storylines. The Titans are way down the flowchart of interesting teams coming into the season. That might change. We'll see what happens. NFL's great because teams can go and put up really spectacular seasons when you didn't anticipate it. Certainly it happens every year. But the Browns are the driving force here. And if 2 years ago you've been making that suggestion, you would have been laughed out of any radio studio in America.
Yeah, and so I wasn't necessarily well, I mean, I looked at the rest of the schedule for that day and the games that I expect CBS to have. And I could see Nance and Romo being at Colts-Chargers.
That's two playoff teams
from last year. That is Andrew Luck, maybe. We assume Andrew Luck versus Phillip Rivers. That's a solid game. Then I look at Chiefs-Jags. That's Patrick Mahomes versus Jalen Ramsey. If nothing else, that's as interesting to me if you're looking at it from a football perspective.
I totally agree.
But Browns-Titans, here's the comparison that I made, and you can tell me if you agree with this. It was also announced this week that the New Orleans Pelicans are going to have 30 games on national television this year. 30. That might be more than they've had the entire time they've had the franchise.
It's the Zion factor, right?
And this is all Baker, about Zion. And this is the Baker Mayfield factor and the, to a little bit lesser degree, Odell Beckham Jr. factor.
Yeah.
There's so much volatility here and there's so much marquee level name recognition with the Browns that they're impossible to deny. And it's a good problem to have because you look at baseball, their guy is Mike Trout, and nobody cares about him because he doesn't care to be out there. Baker Mayfield wants to be out there. Best thing could happen for the NFL is for Baker Mayfield and the Browns to be good this year. Not to be bad, or the worst would be for them to be like a 7-win team.
Yes.
If they're awful,
mediocre is always mediocre is always bad. Like there's a great analogy people say about, for instance, what we do for a living. If you love me, I love you.
Yes.
If you hate me, I love you. If you don't care about anything that I say for 3 hours, then I am failing, right?
Apathy like is
that,
death.
Apathy is, and especially even more so now in a modern media environment. If you don't care about me one way or the other, that's tough. So for Baker Mayfield, you're right. You either want to have the spectacular season where they go out, they win the AFC North, or they contend for it, they make the playoffs, he and OBJ, there's all sorts of different stories associated with it, or you want the spectacular implosion where it's like an accident and you can't look away, right? Either one of those things is a good draw for the NFL. But the fact that they're all in, let me ask you this question. How much of this has to do with Hard Knocks? Because I think Hard Knocks leading into last season was massive for growing the overall fan base of the Cleveland Browns. They were very likable at times. You learned a lot about their internal, you know, sort of employees and the dynamics associated with it. I think Freddie Kitchens is an incredibly likable coach. I certainly think Baker Mayfield is an enigma who provokes reactions. We don't really know that much about Baker Mayfield. He was the same way at Oklahoma, whether it was grabbing his groin or you know, slamming the flag at center field, middle of the field against the Ohio State Buckeyes after a big win, doing the throat slash gesture, I think it was against Georgia. The guy just provokes reactions one way or the other. And so, but I think getting them on Hard Knocks was massive to creating kind of this groundswell of Cleveland Browns' interest.
Yeah, I agree. I think that every year it's really easy to fall into the trap of the team that's on Hard Knocks. Ooh, they're going to have a pretty good season because you watch it all in slow motion and NFL Films is doing all these camera tricks. Every camp looks good when it's through that prism. But the Baker Mayfield thing is Hugh Jackson not giving him a chance and us getting to watch him last year on HBO look pretty good, sound like he knew what he was doing. That made him more endearing. I look at Baker Mayfield.
Made him an underdog.
Yeah, I think Baker Mayfield is a loud, obnoxious version of Drew Brees, potentially right now. Drew Brees is one of the most likable people in the NFL. Baker Mayfield's probably going to be one of the most polarizing guys where I think Cleveland's going to love him. Everybody in that city is going to be endeared to him, but then everybody else is going to probably have one or the other opinion. You talk about the internet extremes in the first hour. The internet extremes on Baker Mayfield are going to be love or hate. I don't think there's going to be a lot of apathy with Baker Mayfield at any point during his career.
No, I think that's completely correct. I mean, I am utterly fascinated, look, to see what's going to happen in that week one, because I think that one of two things is going to happen. I don't think that the 7-9, 8-8 caliber season, 6-10, 9-7, whatever, is likely to happen with the Browns. I think either they come out of the gate firing on all cylinders and they are white hot and they are contending not just for the AFC North, but potentially for a bye in the playoffs, right? All season long. Or I think Freddie Kitchens is that young first-year head coach. He's not really prepared for things. We know what happens with Odell Beckham Jr. He's going to create a stir at some point. The team really hasn't dealt with adversity in a big way, certainly not when the expectations were out there at a high level. And so as a result, if they could stumble early, then it turns into a snowball. I think they're going to be a snowball one way or the other, right? Is it going to be an avalanche that leads to failure, or is it going to be a positive avalanche, which I don't even know what a positive avalanche is. Yeah. But the analogy is here that all of it builds off of like one small pebble, right? Once it gets rolling, the momentum is either going to be tremendous success or tremendous disaster. I don't think there's going to be a middle ground.
Yeah, my biggest question, I think, there's a whole lot of volatility. There's a whole lot of new there for Freddie Kitchens, for Odell, for Kareem Hunt when he comes back off of his suspension with a young defense of Myles Garrett. There's a lot of personalities. And I haven't even mentioned Juice Landry, who was also sort of a star last year on Hard Knocks. But my biggest question is, what happens to Odell Beckham once he realizes Baker Mayfield's the one everybody cares about? Because Odell Beckham talks about how much he loves football, and he might, but he also loves himself being in the spotlight. And he's going to be relegated to page two if the page one story is almost always going to be Baker Mayfield. To me, that might be the biggest dichotomy on this team is, how in the world does Odell deal with not being the center of attention at all times like he was with the Giants?
Yeah, I do think that the challenge that he's got is ultimately it's a quarterback-driven league. And no matter how good a wide receiver is, and I think Antonio Brown is finding this out, I mean, the best player on a team has never been, to win a Super Bowl, has never been the wide receiver. Now, people out there are going to pick apart this thing and say, well, Jerry Rice, no, Joe Montana, right? There has never been in the history of the NFL a situation where the best player on a team was a wide receiver. It's not going to happen with Antonio Brown. If the Raiders are good, it's going to be because Derek Carr returns to his MVP-like form before his injury. If the Cleveland Browns win at a high level this year, it's going to be because Baker Mayfield is flat-out phenomenal. Odell Beckham Jr. is an accompaniment to that. He's not the big stake, right? The stake is always the quarterback. This is my thing with Dak. It's why I wouldn't give big money to Dak, because I don't think ultimately that Dak Prescott is flat out good enough, and we'll find out exactly how good this guy is kind of going forward. I think year two, sophomore season in the NFL, everybody's had time to look at your film. Everybody's had ability to figure out what you do well and what you don't do well. And I think this is our opportunity to see what happens. But I love the fact that the Cleveland Browns are going to be the CBS lead game in week one. My, how things have changed.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We bring in now Frank Isola. He is on ESPN with Around the Horn. He's been guest hosting PTI quite a bit. He also writes at The Athletic, and you can listen to him on Sirius XM. And you can find him at The Frank Isola, I believe, is his Twitter handle. How much harder is it to do PTI compared to Around the Horn? I mean, obviously, I get to be a talking head on Lock It In, which is an hour-long show. But there's a difference between hosting a show and just being a talking head. How much more difficult is it to host?
Yeah, I mean, you know this from doing radio. And, when you're hosting, and especially when, you're writing your own copy as well on PTI.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Also the mechanics kind of when you're reading and then, when to look at the camera. Plus, that show, unlike some other shows on ESPN where, they might have a long time to talk, on PTI, you're talking quickly. So you want to make sure you make a pretty good point and make it more conversational. As you know, with the show that you're on and Around the Horn is just like it, where you have the host, and there's like a little bit more banter back and forth, and you can kind of jump on somebody. But PTI, is the mechanics of it are difficult, but the producers do a really good job. Like the last time I was on it, the Antonio Brown stuff broke really late, and we really shoehorned. They basically rewrote the whole top of the show to get that stuff in there, which was fun because I have a newspaper background, so it kind of that has a newspaper feel to it. It was a Friday, on Friday people are looking to get the heck out. It wasn't it's not a big story. We'll just wait till the weekend. Well, let's see if it becomes a bigger story. Their attitude is no, let's do this right now, which was kind of fun. The New York tabloid expression is kind of ripping up the back page and doing something like a late-breaking story, doing it over again. That's kind of what we did that day, which is fun. It definitely has a bit of a newspaper feel to it.
I feel like an old man in terms of some of my some of the things that I like now. I'm 40. I'm not that old. But one of the things mentioned in the newspapers is I get two newspapers every day still delivered to my house. I get the New York Times and I get the Wall Street Journal. I don't get the local newspaper in my town, but I like to read both of them. Back in the day, how many newspapers would you read a day when you were really in the middle of the newspaper wars in New York City? Were you one of those guys who, if you had some time, you'd get five different newspapers? And I used to love when I would visit New York City to see all those newspapers arrayed. And one of the great things about going to the Washington Post, going to college in D.C., was the Washington Post. And I make fun of myself for this, too. When I was in college, they were already having issues with college kids read newspapers. So in the front of our dorms at George Washington University, where I lived, they would give us the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the USA Today every day for free. And a lot of kids still wouldn't take them. I'd take them and read all four of them every day. I was a newspaper junkie. Were you like that, too?
Absolutely. And first of all, you went to GW, so I would hope they give you something for free. Considering
yeah, that, I think it's $75,000 a year now. It blows my mind.
It give you a couple of free newspapers. It's funny, Clay. I was over covering the Olympics in London in 2012, and that's still a newspaper city. So
yes.
You see in the newsstands and have all the newspapers and the screaming headlines. It really makes it a lot of fun. But when I was when I was growing up, I first of all, I delivered the Daily News, and then I was growing up out on Long Island, and I delivered Newsday. But when I got into the business, I was reading all of them. And when I lived in Brooklyn, you'd go, down to the corner store to get, a cup of coffee, and you would buy all the papers. It was something that you did. Also, this is the different part, too. Back then, I'm on the Nick beat. And if you got beat on a story, and it was on the back page, it was a whole day for you before you can really recover. Now it's different. I know what a lot of newspapers try to do. They might try to post a story at 1-2 in the morning, but you can kind of catch up on that kind of right away. Yes, you and I are going to know who had the story and it'll get written. CNN might put, the New York Times reported, but for just the average person, they don't really get too caught up in it. So you can kind of catch up when you would get beat on a story. There was no worse feeling than going down to the corner store to get all the papers, and there would be some crazy story in the back page that you didn't have, and, your stomach would start to turn. It would be a really bad, long day. Those days are kind of over now because the internet has kind of changed everything.
It's interesting you mentioned London. My wife still makes fun of me because we've been over to London. We went over for the Titans-Chargers game, took the kids, and we went over for my 40th birthday for a few days. I will still buy, because you're right, London is still, even now, you mentioned 2012 Olympics, even now, it's still a popular newspaper city. I studied abroad in London, and I would buy all the British newspapers. My wife makes fun of me because when we get on the flight to come back, you know, it's a 7 or 8 hour flight coming back to Nashville from London, and I'll go on with like 5 pounds of London newspapers, right? Like all the tabloids, everything. Like I love it, even though I don't even know all the scandals and stuff they're writing about. Like there's just something so enjoyable to me about still turning a newspaper and not knowing what's going to be on the next page.
And you know, the one thing about over there, and it's true of kind of the commentary, if you watch the sports, especially if you watch like the Premier League, the soccer,
yes.
They can be, you know, and you would fit into this category because you have no problem being honest and, you know, you'll be critical at times. But as long as you're not taking cheap shots at people and talking about the way they look or, you know, silly things like that, it's kind of all fair game. But our society now has become, if you're critical of anybody, well, that means you're a hater.
Yeah.
Over there, it's still kind of refreshing that, you know, and they'll go after their best players. If their
yes.
best players didn't play well, they hold their highest players accountable. In our country, a lot of guys in the media will rip like that second and third level guy. You're not really a tough guy doing that. Let's hold like the highest players to the highest standard. And over like in Europe, that's definitely a big thing, which kind of makes it refreshing that they're not afraid to go after the big guys.
Speaking of the big guys, Jay-Z has now got a partnership with the NFL. A big story on Wednesday morning in the Wall Street Journal. I'm actually surprised it didn't get more attention. New York Times has a big story about it. I was reading. I'm curious if you've ever met Jay-Z. You've covered New York sports for so long. He is an icon in the city of New York. And what do you think about his decision to join the NFL and the NFL's decision to join with him?
First of all, I've never met him. I did sit behind his wife at a Houston Rockets-Knicks game a million years ago, which was pretty cool.
Jim. Yeah.
She wasn't that crazy into the game. She was watching it. But the whole thing seems a little weird. I spoke to someone who he was one of the chosen few that got to attend the press conference on Wednesday. And apparently all throughout the press conference, all everybody asked about was Colin Kaepernick. And at one point, Jay-Z said that he had spoken to him. And I guess something later came out that Colin Kaepernick said he hadn't spoken to Jay-Z. So the whole thing is a little odd. As you know, I can't believe how big of a deal gets made over like the Super Bowl halftime show. Like, I get it. It's like a
yeah.
big thing to perform there. But Peter, listen, I don't really like the band that sang at the last one. I forget the guy's name. Is it Adam Levine? But I thought that guy got eviscerated
yes.
for performing. I guess that has a lot to do. Everybody makes a big deal who's performing and who should be performing. And it's in Atlanta, so it should be this kind of act. What is the big deal here? It's a Super Bowl. You're appealing to a broad audience. But that has something to do with it. But obviously, Colin Kaepernick, clearly the media thought that, because that apparently, like I said, the person I spoke to attended the press conference on Wednesday said almost every question was about Colin Kaepernick.
Speaking of crazy press conferences, you've covered Eli Manning for a long time, and he has been, I think he's probably become, I don't know if you agree with me, the biggest punching bag in the entirety of the NFL. It's almost like there's nobody left to defend Eli. Such that Daniel Jones was probably the biggest punching bag of all the draft picks. He goes out and looks good in the first preseason game, and then the Giants come out and say they expect Eli to play all 16. First, do you agree that of all the NFL quarterbacks right now, Eli, who's won 2 Super Bowls, is crazily probably the most criticized quarterback almost in the NFL now? And two, do you think he'll play all 16?
Yeah, I do think the criticism is a bit unfair, and I've always felt that Eli has handled himself very well. I thought really the one time where he didn't handle things well is when Ben McAdoo, you know, made the announcement that they were going to pull him out of the lineup, and then that, you know, then Eli's streak was going to end, and it didn't. I believe that was against the Raiders where the streak ended, and Eli really made a big deal about that. In fact, he got almost emotional, and I get it. There's a source of pride that you have with having the streak, but as you know, like, baseball has numbers, and that's what everything is ruled on. You know, 300 wins and, you know, the home run record. Football's not like that. We don't really care, like, who has the consecutive streak for most starts by an NFL quarterback. It's great for Eli Manning, but all we ever thought about Eli was he was all about team. And in that moment, I kind of thought he was all about himself, and it probably expedited Ben McAdoo getting fired. And here we are 2 years later with John Mara talking about him playing all 16 games. And I think what John Mara was saying was, as long as we're winning, he's going to stay as the quarterback. But if you remember, Kurt Warner was the quarterback when Eli Manning first showed up. And, you know, I think they were 5-4 at the time, or 4-5 when Eli started. So I think as long as Eli's winning, he'll stay in there. But come on, you don't draft a quarterback 6 overall for him to just sit on the bench. It worked for Patrick Mahomes. Jared Goff started his first year. We're all wondering, man, maybe the guy's not any good. So there's no set formula for a quarterback. But I don't think there's any doubt that Daniel Jones is going to be the guy. I think it's going to happen this year. And I thought it was funny, Clay. I don't know if you heard it, but Pat Shurmur after the game, where the media was, you know, asking Pat Shurmur questions about how well Daniel Jones played, and he had a snide remark like, yeah, we kind of knew it when we drafted him. That was his way of getting back at the media a little bit for all the criticism that Daniel Jones got, which I felt also was a little unfair, because you know how it is, though. You're a prep school-looking kid who went to Duke, so no one's going to give you the benefit of the doubt. But I'll say this. He's had a better so-called preseason than Zion Williamson has had thus far. So had a Duke guys drafted pretty high, Daniel Jones has actually had a better start to his career than Zion Williamson.
Well, he definitely looked a lot better than Dwayne Haskins, which is the other guy that a lot of Giants fans wanted them to get, right?
Right.
It's not like Kyler Murray was in the mix. It was either Daniel Jones or Dwayne Haskins. And Haskins came out, threw a couple of picks, looked pretty bad for the Redskins. Daniel Jones looked very prepared and ready to play for the Giants. Okay, the other big quarterback controversy that I'm sure you've been talking and writing and discussing to no end is Dak Prescott. What is the dollar figure to you? If I said Dak Prescott $30 million a year, does that make sense to you, or do you think that's a ridiculous contract for Jerry Jones and the Cowboys to sign?
I think it's ridiculous. I can't imagine that he would turn that down.
I agree.
He's got to be nuts to do that. And I heard what you said. I kind of agree as well. I think, you know, everyone's talking about the Eagle quarterback that he should be compared to is Carson Wentz. Well, Carson Wentz makes this much, and he's had this many wins compared to Carson Wentz. All right, well, if we're going to compare him to Eagle quarterbacks, I agree with you. Let's compare him to Nick Foles, who played for the Eagles, won 4 playoff games, including a Super Bowl, and he's got $22 million a year at Jacksonville. All right, so I'll tell you what. We'll give you a little bit more than that. That's not a fair deal. Dak Prescott is a very – I think you could win – a Super Bowl with Dak Prescott. I'm not saying I don't think it's impossible, but you know, he's not, you know, Tom Brady. He's not Drew Brees. He's not Russell Wilson. He just isn't. He's good, and I hope he gets paid. But this idea that like he wants $34 million, I mean, come on now. You know, you're good. I think the Cowboys, they could probably find someone actually cheaper than that who could probably do just about the same that you can.
Yeah, the challenge is also balancing that out with the fact that Amari Cooper is going to want to get paid, and clearly Zeke Elliott wants to get paid because he hasn't been in training camp yet, and all three of those guys can't cost you, you know, $60 million plus just based on the way the NFL salary cap works right now. I know you cover the U.S. men's team. I haven't even paid much attention to this, but evidently Serbia's been chirping.
The coach of Serbia had a great line about playing the U.S. He said, you know, they just better worry about themselves, and if they end up playing us, meaning Serbia, may God help them. So that, it's great that he's talking a lot of junk. But here's the thing, too. I looked it up. The Serbian roster has 10 guys whose last name end with itch. You know,
yes.
Like Jokic, Teodosic, Bogdanovic. They got 10 of those guys. But if they were to play, if you look at the two rosters, Jokic is, you know, I would put him better than Kemba Walker. So he'd be the best player. I think he's better than Donovan Mitchell. So if the two teams played, Serbia would have the best player. They have enough NBA guys. So I hope it kind of happens, but you know how it is. The NBA players, whether or not they're from the U.S. or other countries, a lot of them just don't want to dedicate 6 weeks this summer to international basketball. They'll do it next summer for the Olympics because they look at it differently, but you could tell that a lot of guys are saying, man, I got to give up 6 weeks of my summer, and this is just the World Cup, which let's face it, especially in this country, we think of the Olympic gold medal. We hold that in much higher regard than we do a World Cup medal for basketball. So that's why a lot of guys have bailed out. But I think it's left the team vulnerable. And Greg Popovich, I was there in 04 in Athens, Greece, when the U.S. lost. And Greg Popovich was the assistant coach. And I think the last thing that he wants to do now is go over to China and not come home with the gold medal.
We started off talking about London and some of the EPL. Christian Pulisic has made his debut for Chelsea. I don't know how much you've gotten to watch. What is the expectation for him? How good is he? And for people out there in America who may not really understand how significant this is, how big of a deal is it to have Pulisic at this age? I think he just turned 19 or he's about to turn 20. I mean, he's insanely young to be playing at the level that he is.
It's an unbelievable story. And, you know, it's one thing for him to be playing in Germany. There's a lot of American players that played there. A lot of players whose dads are American servicemen. We know we have a lot of military bases over there. But for Christian Pulisic to come from Hershey, Pennsylvania, to end up at a young age playing for Dortmund, which is a good team, but to go sign at Chelsea, you know, that's one of the top clubs in the world with, you know, Roman Abramovich. The owner has got, you know, just as much money as anybody. He came off the bench the first game, and then he started the, you know, that game on Wednesday, the UEFA Super Cup. That's when they had the team that won the Champions League and the Europa League. He started that and had an assist on Chelsea's first goal. So he's done really well. It's an amazing accomplishment. That's, you know, it's to have an American player playing for, you know, one of the best clubs in the world, and he's good. He's got a lot of talent. It is still amazing that we haven't produced more players like this. Our country's so big, but, you know, you live in the South. All the guys that you know, they all the best athletes all want to play football and basketball. But it's still kind of amazing that a country this big, we haven't produced that many world-class soccer players.
Outstanding as always. He's Frank Isola at the Frank Isola on Twitter. Go follow him there. I'm Clay Travis. This is Outkick, the coverage. Up next, discussion of the best college towns on Fox Sports Radio.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Outkick the coverage. I hope all of you are having a fantastic Thursday, wherever you may be across this great land. Jason Martin with me here. I'm Clay Travis. And I saw this list, Sports Illustrated. It's the 150th anniversary of college football. And Sports Illustrated's coming out with a list of the greatest college towns. And so I feel like we could probably do a whole hour on this at some point. But in the meantime, they came out with their top 10. And I want to hit you with it, Jason Martin, see what you think. What cities you think were left off this list that should be higher. And I've been fortunate to go around to a lot of these different college towns. So I'm going to go in reverse order here. 10th best college town in America, according to Sports Illustrated, Charlottesville, Virginia. It's obviously where the University of Virginia is. 9th best college town, College Station, Texas, where Texas A&M is. Knoxville, Tennessee, number 8 on this list, where the University of Tennessee is. Oxford, Mississippi, Ole Miss is there. Boulder, Colorado, where the University of Colorado is. Columbia, Missouri, where the University of Missouri is number 5, by the way. I haven't been counting very well. 4 is Ann Arbor, Michigan, where the University of Michigan is. 3 is Austin, Texas, where the University of Texas is. Athens, Georgia is number 2 on this list, where the University of Georgia is. And the number 1 college football town in America, Madison, Wisconsin. All right, so I don't want to come off the top rope on Madison, Wisconsin, but I'll just say this straight up. It ain't the number 1 college town in America.
No.
All right? It's not close. Now, Athens, Georgia as number 2. I think Athens is as perfect of a college town as exists in America. Let me explain my categories for what I think makes a great college town. First of all, it can't be a huge city. Like, so I understand Austin, Texas may be great. Where I live, Nashville, Tennessee is also great. It is a great town to be in if you are a young college graduate. But it's also a city, right? Like Knoxville, Tennessee is a city to me as well. Athens, Georgia, not a city, right? To me, to have a great college town, it has to actually be a town. It can't be a city. Madison, Wisconsin is also too big. Austin, Texas, too big. Knoxville, Tennessee, too big. Just like Nashville, Tennessee is too big. So Madison, Wisconsin is not in the running here. To me, it needs to be a town. But it needs to be a town that has a close city in proximity, which makes Austin, Athens perfect. Because if you've ever been to Athens, Georgia, it's not that far outside of Atlanta. So you get the college town experience, but if you were want to, for instance, go back to a big city, you're not that far away. So I would say Athens, in my opinion, is the best college town in America. What do you think is the best college town in America in your experience? And obviously, you haven't been to every single one. So yeah, we're not saying that necessarily we've been to every single one. Have been to a lot of them, by the way. So that would be kind of my breakdown. What would you say?
I think that's a good one. I mean, I look at Charlottesville, and that one's close to my heart because I grew up going to Charlottesville with my dad and his best friend and his daughter. I loved it. I mean, we went to Scott Stadium every year.
By the way, how is Chapel Hill not on this list?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I went to NC State, so I was in Chapel Hill a lot of the time. It's tremendous, and that's the only thing in that city. You know about Franklin Street, and you know about the Dean Dome, and you know about their football stadium and that school, and that's it. And I think that that's important as well. If there's one that I see that's not on here that I could see on here, and I could also see maybe Columbus, Ohio or something like that, but
Columbus too big.
Yeah, okay. I think Baton Rouge is one that I would put on here. I mean, LSU is kind of incredible.
Baton Rouge is great. It's too big. Again, I mean, like, really? If you, it's too big of a city. I mean, it's the state capital of Louisiana. It's just too big of a city, in my opinion, to be on the list, much like Knoxville is too big, I think, much like Austin, Texas, Madison.
Okay.
The ones that I think are left off that I've visited and had experience in, and I'm like, this is a great college town. I think that Chapel Hill would have to be on any list that you did, the University of North Carolina. I think Clemson is pretty phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Like everything that's for you, this is your neck of the woods,
yeah,
right?
I lived 20 miles from that campus for 5-6 years.
I mean, it's pretty outstanding, right?
True.
I think it's a, I did a book called Dixielander Light where I went around to all the SEC stadiums. As much as I like Texas A&M, College Station is not one of the 10 best college towns in America.
What about State College, Pennsylvania?
State College, Pennsylvania is pretty phenomenal. I loved it. Went up there, watched the Ohio State-Penn State game last year. I think it should be on the list. I think it's a great example of one that should be on the list. When I think of college towns, I think of places that are distinct universes, where when you're on that campus, you think, man, this place is amazing. I really feel like I have a unique feel here. I'll give you another one. Palo Alto, where Stanford is. Absolutely extraordinary college town, great environment, walking around that campus. Palo Alto is a decent size, but you feel like you're in like kind of a college bubble when you're in that area right around Stanford's campus. I think it should be on the list. I think I'm running through, you know, it's such an interesting list that Sports Illustrated put together. I'm going to put a pin in this one, by the way. We need to just have a whole hour one day, maybe even a whole show.
Have people call in. This is a call-in topic.
Yeah, I feel like this is a great summer show that we need to dive into. But in the meantime, I wanted to hit the SI list and give you a sense for what we thought. This is Outkick, by the way. Can't wait for college football to get back here August 24th. By the way, next Wins and Losses podcast is going to be up on Sunday. Joel Klatt will be our guest. He's the lead college football voice for Fox Sports. He's also going to join us every single Friday all season, I believe beginning tomorrow. Final segment of the show, we break down the 5 NFL preseason games going on Thursday night. That's Outkick, Fox Sports Radio.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick, the coverage with Clay Travis, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
Final segment of the show, Thursday edition of Outkick, the coverage. We got 5 NFL preseason games going on tonight. Eagles-Jags, Jets-Falcons, Bengals, Redskins, Packers, Ravens, Raiders, and Cardinals. I don't know about you, Jason Martin, but when I watch all these games, it's like almost like you're watching a horror film and you're just hoping that somebody's not going to get hurt, because if you play fantasy football or if you've bought any futures tickets for sports gambling at all, it's like every one of these games just gives you an opportunity to get a key player actually injured. I would say of all these games that are going on, the one that I'm most intrigued to watch is Raiders-Cardinals, just because the Kyler Murray story is really intriguing to me. The gamble that the Cardinals have taken by bringing in Cliff Kingsbury, building an entire offense around him, that's probably number one on my list if I have to watch a preseason game. It's to see how Kyler Murray's going to do. What would you say?
I don't think it's close, especially because Gruden reportedly wanted Kyler Murray also, and there's that tie-in to where the Raiders have a quarterback that we're still not sure he actually wants, and then they're staring down the gullet of maybe the future dependent upon all of this. And the problem there is you just don't want to see anybody get hurt. Like you mentioned, Kyler at his stature is going to be more interesting to watch dependent upon how often he plays. I guess maybe second on the list is probably Green Bay and Baltimore, just because Lamar Jackson's more entertaining or more interesting to me, more of an intriguing story than most of the rest of this. And I guess if I had to go third, it'd probably be Cincy Washington, just because I want to see what Dwayne Haskins does after throwing two awful interceptions, being a guy that was drafted. A large reason why is because he was so protective of the football and didn't turn it over at Ohio State. Those two interceptions last week looked like definitely number three on a depth chart behind Colt McCoy and Case Keenum. And I actually like Dwayne Haskins, so I'm a little bit interested in that. But overall, preseason football doesn't really get it done for me.
Yeah, well, it doesn't get it done for anybody. And it's interesting, the preseason football ratings have been pretty awful so far. And my argument, by the way, I would say the second most interesting game is Bengals-Redskins, primarily because, for what you just said, what's going to happen at the Redskins quarterback position? there's a legitimate battle going on. Dwayne Haskins was not very good in the first game that he played, and we'll see whether or not that continues in week two or if he shows a little bit of growth. But I would make the argument about preseason football that I think is intriguing here is that we have reached such a glut of entertainment in this country that it used to be you could just toss out football, and even if it was preseason, people would watch it. Now I think there are a lot of people who are listening to us on their way into work, starting off their day, and they're like, yeah, I could watch preseason football, but I've got a ton of shows backed up on my DVR, and the real games haven't started yet. I'd rather watch one of the other entertainment options. I think we're in this universe where what's big becomes bigger than it ever has before. Like, Game of Thrones is almost as big as anything could possibly be. But if you're not on that supercharged level, it's almost like with entertainment and concerts. You know, if you're Taylor Swift or you are Beyonce and Jay-Z or you are Ed Sheeran, like, you can sell out arenas in the snap of your fingers. But if you're not a huge superstar, there's no middle class. And I feel like preseason NFL football is lower class. It's not even middle class entertainment. And as a result, people are tuning it out. I think it's going to become even more of the case. And that's why I think in this new bargaining agreement between the owners and the players, players might not want to play 18 games, but I think certainly the NFL can't get away very much longer with selling four preseason games.
I agree, and I could just take what you just said, and I've made this argument over and over. I've made it on the Jason Martin Show. I've made it on this show in the past. What you just said is why the XFL is going to fail. It's why the AAF failed. It's why spring football will fail. Because we're not watching games with franchises we recognize right now because we don't think that they matter. You're telling me that the XFL is going to matter to us? I just don't buy that in any respect. So I look at this. Now, yeah, it's not preseason. Those games are going to compete for whatever their championship is going to be. But you're trying to make me care about that when entertainment is so oversaturated.
The difference is
it's
only
not elite.
If they produce 10% of the audience, they're wildly successful.
That's true. And Vince has already said he's already earmarked over $400 million that he is expecting to lose in the first 3 years. And that's different than a lot of these leagues that have to succeed immediately or they go under. He's already assuming that they can't even break even for 3 years, which I do think is some level of recognition of what this is going to be and what a challenge this is going to be. I'm just saying, I don't know in 3 years whether or not I care about this either. And I'd still be surprised if it's around in 3 years.
That's a whole nother debate. We'll get into it at some point, I'm sure, in the future. But for now, Thursday night NFL preseason action going on. We'll be back to break it down for you on Friday. I'm Clay Travis. He's Jason Martin. This has been Outkick the Coverage on Fox Sports Radio. Hope all of you have a great Thursday night. We'll be back with you tomorrow on Outkick.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.